This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We're going to get started for the second half. It's always nice to do a debate. The idea of having a debate is really comes from like day-to-day experience that we have. When we come across certain clinical scenarios or decisions, and then we realize that you can make arguments on either side, and then there's really no right or wrong answers because of the sparsity of guidelines from the literature. So this year we will have this debate by two of our great young hepatologists, Bilal Hamid and Danielle Brandman. I would say that Bilal and Hamid, they actually share a lot of similarities. They may not look alike, but they really share a lot of similarities. So both of them are like among the best clinicians we have. They're both very interested in fatty liver disease, and they've both done really tremendous work in addition to doing research and taking care of patients, but also they play a vital role in the education of our fellows, being closely involved with the fellowship program. And Bilal is also doing a really nice job with the outpatient hepatology clinic. I also think that the two of them are very evenly matched in this debate, and we'll see what the outcome is going to be. And Bilal is trying really hard to grow his hair back after the pilgrimage so that he will look good for this meeting and so that you can all recognize him. So we're going to start with Danielle Brandman. Danielle has been with us now for 2 years and really has done extremely well. She's going to start this debate, beta blocker versus band ligation, and then you are pro beta blocker, the good old beta blocker. Danielle?
Well, thank you, Francis, for that wonderful introduction. Really appreciate it. So this is clearly a very interesting topic, and I think a little bit controversial as well. And actually, look, if you look at the ASLD guidelines on primary prophylaxis for esophageal varices, there's no clear guideline. You could do either. So like Francis said, there's really no right or wrong answer, but hopefully I'll prove to you that my side is the right side. So just to frame this, we'll just have a case. We have a 55-year-old woman. Of course, she has NASH cirrhosis because Bilal and I are discussing this case. And she's coming in for her first endoscopy. She's never had any variceal bleeding in the past. So you've consented her for the procedure, and you do mention the possibility of band ligation. And she wants to know, well, what are her other options? So, like Francis said, I'm going to talk about the good old beta blocker. But before I do that, I do want to first go into the pathophysiology of varices formation and bleeding, which I'm sure everyone in this room is well aware of. But just as a refresher, we know that when patients have cirrhosis, this presents an increased resistance to portal flow, which leads to increased portal pressures, which can dilate pre-existing vessels, thereby leading to varice formation. There are also increasing concentrations of vasodilatory substances, which thereby leads to angiogenesis and, again, fosters the formation of varices. The other thing that we know is that you do need a portal pressure gradient of at least 10 to 12 in order for varices to be present. So what is the natural history of varices? They're very common, present in about 50% of our patients with cirrhosis, more common in patients with Child C cirrhosis, with those patients having an 85% prevalence versus 40% in Child A cirrhosis. Each year, patients with cirrhosis have an 8% risk of developing varices, and of those who have varices each year, the risk of varices enlarging is also 8%. The risk of variceal hemorrhage each year is 5 to 15%, and the predictors of hemorrhage include larger varices, decompensated cirrhosis, and a pressure gradient greater than 20. We think we can reduce the risk of bleeding if we can reduce the HVPG to less than 12 or by 20% from the baseline values. And the risk of mortality with each variceal bleed is 20%. So clearly a very clinically relevant issue that we're dealing with here. So going back to pathophysiology, thinking about, well, why do we actually use beta blockers? What are they doing? So they do reduce the portal pressure. So again, decreasing the risk of formation or enlargement of varices. Can also decrease the amount of splanchnic vasodilatation and decrease the amount of portal blood flow. So really attacking the varices formation and growth on a few different ends. So let's go into the data now. Beta blockers work for small varices. There was a placebo-controlled trial comparing nadolol and placebo in 161 patients who had small varices on endoscopy. And at 3 years, patients who were on nadolol, only 11% had progressed to large varices versus 37%, as shown in this graph over here. The nadolol patients are on top. These patients also had a lower risk of having variceal bleed as compared with placebo. And again, the nadolol group is on top. Despite this difference, there was no difference in survival between placebo and nadolol. Beta blockers also work well for patients with medium and large varices. And there are so many studies out there that I've really just chosen to show the data from meta-analysis just for the sake of time. This meta-analysis included 9 studies that had almost 1,000 patients that compared beta blockers to no treatment. And looking at the top graph over here, we see that the odds are in favor of using beta blockers, that there was a significantly reduced risk of bleeding in patients who are on beta blockers, reduced by about 46%. If you translate that into number needed to treat, you only have to give 11 patients a beta blocker in order to prevent one episode of variceal bleeding. If you look at the graph below, while there was not a statistically significant difference between patients on beta blockers versus patients on no treatment, I think you can see pretty clearly that the trend is really in favor of using beta blockers. So I think decent data to show beta blockers work pathophysiologically makes sense as well. So this is just some more data from another meta-analysis, about 600 patients were included. And again, what we see, sorry, I'm falling into the cracks here. The patients who are on beta blockers had a lower risk of having variceal bleeding compared with patients who were on no treatment. Patients who died from variceal bleeding was less common in the patients on beta blockers, and they also had a lower risk of overall death as well. Now, we're debating the beta blockers between beta blockers and variceal ligation, so I'll show you that data as well. So in this study, we found that there was surprisingly no difference in episodes of bleeding between patients randomized to beta blockers versus those who were treated with band ligation, with the incidence of bleeding being 30% in the propranolol group versus 25% in the band ligation group. Not surprisingly, the sicker patients, childs B and C, were at greater risk of bleeding. I think one important thing to note here is that in the patients in this study, 90% of the patients in the band ligation group did achieve successful eradication of varices. And this was involving patients going for scopes and banding every 2 weeks until the varices were eradicated. Despite that, 40% ended up developing recurrent varices. There was no difference in survival between the two groups as well. So I think the key point from this is that while the two treatments did appear to be equally effective, it does require really strict adherence to the banding protocol in order to have eradication of the varices. So carvedilol is the newest player on the block in terms of the beta blockers, and it appears to be very effective in primary prophylaxis in patients who have medium or large varices. And in the graph on the left, we see that carvedilol resulted in much lower rates of bleeding than band ligation, 10 versus 23%, with a relative hazard of about 0.41. Despite this, there was no difference in survival between the two groups. The important thing to note, just thinking about the prior study, is that about 17% of the patients in the band ligation group actually were not compliant with the band ligation protocol. So looking at another meta-analysis that compared beta blockers versus band ligation in patients who had medium to large varices, you see that the effects are somewhat similar. The overall mortality in the beta blocker and the band ligation group is about 23-24%. Bleeding-related mortality is similar as well. The risk of bleeding was slightly lower in the beta blocker group compared with the band ligation group, but I'll call your attention to the complications. Patients on beta blockers, we know the complications can include bradycardia, dizziness, shortness of breath, but most of these may not be necessarily immediately life-threatening. Patients who are undergoing band ligation have the risk of bleeding, esophageal perforation, as well as pain. So just to go into a little bit more detail about the disadvantages of band ligation, we do know for banding to be effective, there is a need for serial endoscopy about every 2 weeks in order to have optimal effectiveness. Now, even in the face of a clinical trial, we saw that almost 20% of the patients in the band ligation group were still not able to comply with that recommendation for banding every 2 weeks. This is expensive. If we're scoping these patients every 2 weeks, that's a lot of healthcare dollars to take into account. There's procedural risk with doing procedures on these patients every 2 weeks at all, as well, and especially if we're sedating our patients with child C cirrhosis, they might be at increased periprocedural risk as well. The other thing to consider is that, especially if we're thinking about the patients on our transplant list, a lot of them are thrombocytopenic, coagulopathic. They may need blood products to support them to have a safe procedure as well. And this last point may not pertain to the patients in the Bay Area, where we have many very qualified gastroenterologists, but thinking more broadly outside of this area, patients may not have adequate access to gastroenterologists and may not be able to come in every 2 weeks or so and have their varices banded. Other things to take into consideration, patients do complain of discomfort. This may be related to passage of the banding device at the time of endoscopy. They can develop chest pain as a consequence of banding. And then post-banding ulcers or other bleeding episodes as a consequence of banding is a problem as well. So there was a cost-effectiveness analysis that compared the use of beta blockers versus band ligation, and this included about 1,000 patients or so. Looking at the absolute cost of beta blockers between band and comparing it to band ligation, beta blockers, not surprisingly, was cheaper. Effectiveness, when measured in life years, was similar between the two groups. Number of bleeding episodes was slightly greater in the beta blocker group. About 2.5% of patients needed TIPS overall. But death rates between the two groups were quite similar. If we look at the incremental cost-effectiveness ratio, it's actually in favor of beta blockers by about $100,000. So I think this is another key piece of information that really tips in favor of use of beta blockers. So to conclude, we know that variceal bleeding is a very common complication in patients with cirrhosis. Beta blockers are safe, they're effective, they prevent variceal hemorrhage and death. And I believe they should be favored over band ligation because of superior effectiveness. decrease cost as well as universal availability. Thank you.
Great. Very strong argument. We need a rebuttal, and I think Bilal is up for it. Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. So last time, Neil was with debate with Rio, and Neil lost, and he's on call now. So whoever we're going to lose, I think, will be taking the next NAPA call. So I have to try my best to win this. So Danielle has beautifully presented the data about the beta blocker and also beautifully avoid a lot of complications from beta blocker that we are seeing, and I will try to focus on that. So let's see. Where can I go? Okay. So my point is very simple, that band ligation is better than non-selective beta blocker for primary prophylaxis. And this is actually one of the few things that as a hepatologist we have, normally the hepatologists are most fun-loving and we work together very well, but this is always, even as a fellow, I always think that, you know, whenever we go in, different attendings have a different perception and they always tell, okay, band-aid, and then say beta blocker. So let's see what we need to do. So Danielle has presented some data about non-selective beta blocker and comparing with placebo. So we have to look at all the studies together and see what is the different treatment modality if you compare it between the placebo versus the treatment. So if you don't treat anyone, there is a 20% risk of bleeding with the first episode. If you look at the beta blocker, the first episode of bleed decreased to 17%. And Danielle had mentioned that the number needed to treat was about 10 or 11, depending on which study you look. But if you compared the band ligation versus placebo, the effect of band ligation is much higher. And the number needed to treat is about 4. And also, the first episode of bleed does decrease from 27 to 10%. So even if you compare it between placebo and band ligation, the effect of band ligation is definitely superior. So there's a lot of argument, and there's most of the endoscopy critics argue about taking this study, which is published in 2005, and this study was terminated early because there was a lot of bleeding in the band ligation arm. And the problem with this study, number one, is that it was stopped after 5 years, and there were only less than 1/4 of the participant was actually able to recruit, 52 out of 214 with a planned analysis. And 60% of these patients in the study had small varices. So they were banding small varices, the risk of bleeding was much higher. And they did another unplanned interim analysis and did not actually show any difference between the mortality as well as risk of bleeding. So between 1998 and 2010, there has been 19 randomized controlled trials that has been performed between comparing band ligation versus beta blocker. And 5 of these randomized controlled trials has shown that band ligation is superior to prevent the episode of variceal bleed in 5 of these trials as compared to other trials having propranolol and nadolol. There's only one trial which Danielle had mentioned of carvedilol, which actually showed that the band ligation is less superior than beta blocker. But that trial also, which Danielle did not mention, was that there were also a lot of small, you know, there are large varices, but that the compliance rate was low. But at the same time, there's no other trial that has shown that the patient had compliance issue with band ligation. And that was the only trial, and that was discussed in multiple different studies, that was the reason that carvedilol. And there actually a poster in 2014, just last week, ASLD, which also showed that they are similar, the carvedilol and band ligation. The problem with most of these studies is these are all different studies, and the sample size is different between 24 to 152 patients. The length of studies are completely separable, like they're 11 months to 55 months. There are only two studies that were followed for more than 2 years. And the group of patients which we think has the highest risk of bleeding, the child sees cirrhosis, is only few trials that have it. It's less than one-third of the patient most of the trial. And the alcohol cirrhosis or etiology of liver disease were only different. So most of these trials were underpowered. And actually, if you want to do a good clinical trial, you need to have about 500 patients in each arm to actually show that there will be a difference. So I doubt that we will ever have a good clinical trial randomized that can compare it. So we have to depend on the meta-analysis and try to figure out what we can get out of it. So different meta-analysis has been done, and this was the one which was published in 2011. This was published in Canadian Journal of Gastroenterology for Nora and my Canadian fellows that I do read or try to read. So that trial also shows that if you look at the first episode of variceal bleed, the non-selective beta blocker versus band-ligation, it is point towards more towards band-ligation. The second trial, which was meta-analysis, which was the last one, was 2012, and also shows that the first episode or overall decreased risk of GI bleed was better in band ligation, which is 14 versus 20%. And also the decreased risk of first variceal bleed was 13% versus 19%. They tried to divide it in patient which has a small number or patient who has been followed by less than 2 years. But again, the point was that there were more studies have shown that the band ligation was superior than beta blocker in preventing the first episode of bleed. However, if I agree with Danielle that actually it is not superior, but it is comparable, then we have to figure out whether we can use beta blocker in on our patient. And that's what the next part of my talk will focus on. So beta blocker, which considered as an aspirin of hepatologists, because most of our patients, we use it very commonly, but there are a lot of limitations of non-selective beta blockers. So first of all, when you start beta blocker, it's a lifelong therapy. You have to continue these patients for lifelong. There is more data coming out that if patients stop it or you stop the non-selective beta blocker, there is a rebound portal hypertension and increased risk of bleeding. You need to follow these patients, and you have to adjust the dose. Most of the clinical trials, if you look at it, the average dose of non-selective beta blocker of propranolol was at least 60 milligram, and nadolol, you have to go up to 60 milligram also to around to have a good effect. The treatment withdrawal happens in about 15% of the patients. Only 30 to 50% patients can achieve the desired reduction in hepatovenous pressure gradient, which we call responders, and I'm going to show some of the studies about it. The important thing which we check is the heart rate, but there is no data that heart rate do correlate with the decrease in the pressure gradient. And there is, in Europe, they try to monitor the gradient and just direct the therapy, which is not available here. So when you look at the adverse effect in the clinical trial, there are about more than 50% of patients in the clinical trials, and these are clinical trials, and you choose like about Child's A, Child's B, and Child's C patient have a lot of problems. 21% patient had fatigue, hypertension, which is a big problem in our population already with patient who has especially decompensated cirrhosis. They cannot tolerate any increased dose of non-selective beta blocker, dyspnea, nausea, dizziness, all these side effects is significantly much higher. When you compare the life-threatening, there is only one in all the clinical trial, there was only one esophageal perforation which happened in the band ligation. It was time when people were using over tubes. And most of the complications that happened in band ligation was older studies, and they didn't have the multi-bander apparatus at that time. And the techniques have improved a lot in band ligation also. So those side effects are much less now than what we see. About 50% of patients in the band ligation have superficial ulceration, but if you compared all the studies, there were only 3% patients had ulcer-related bleed, which was controlled by endoscopy. So the concept of which are the group of patients who actually respond to non-selective beta blocker, right? And when we use the word, what are the responder, we use hepatic venous pressure gradient, that they has to decrease by greater than 20% to have a response, or ideally less than 12 millimeter of mercury, that's what you required. So if you start non-selective beta blocker and if you don't respond to this, you have 32% risk of having a bleed. However, if you're able to decrease it to more than 20 decrease of the pressure gradient, you can have a 6% risk of bleed. But only 30% of those patients we in the studies have able to achieve that decrease of the gradient. If you make it less than 12, you absolutely have no risk of bleeding. But in all the studies, only 20% of patients we can reach the target. So you have to direct the therapy, but if you use the therapy which we cannot able to have a successful outcome, there is no point of using it then. At the same time, there's another study which what they did actually an 8-year follow-up studies. They found out that which are the group of people who are responder and the non-responder. Again, the same concept of responder. And if you're able to respond, you have 95% that you would not bleed our first episode. However, if you do not respond, you have a 45% chance of having a bleed. And in this study also, 65% of the patients were non-responder. Again, proving the fact that non-selective beta blocker, we can use it, but actually respond to the treatment is very hard. Non-selective beta blocker is a lifelong commitment. So this was a study. What they did was this group has previously done a prospective randomized controlled trial. And they went back and see, okay, which were the group of patients on this trial who were on placebo and which was on non-selective beta blocker, which they stopped it because of the side effects. And they found out the people who were on propranolol arm and they stopped it, they actually have an increased poor survival as compared to placebo. And based on this trial, there was a whole study that comes out or the whole protocol that you need to have these patients on non-selective beta blocker for life. Now, the cost effectiveness and quality of life. We talk about cost effectiveness, but we have to also look at what is the quality of life. There are a lot of different studies has been done, and they are actually, depending on how you actually do the trial and what markers you use it, the ligation is actually, these are trials that shows the ligation is more cost effective. There's actually a clinical trial that if you look at all the cumulative direct costs, there is no difference in the both modality. And the patient preference, which is a surrogate marker of quality of trial, they actually also shown that it's better in pan ligation. So who should make the decision, right? We actually, we never talk to the patient what kind of a treatment you need. We actually make a decision on our own. We do the endoscopy and say, okay, I'm going to give you the beta blocker, I'll do the ligation. But patient has to be an equal partner in the decision making. And there is a study that was done, and they actually asked the preference of the patients. So this was studied in 17 different centers around the Connecticut area, and they have 53 patients and 61 physicians were enrolled. 64% of the patient and 57% of the physician preferred band ligation over non-selective beta blocker. They have a computerized pattern of the asking about all these questions and side effects with both treatment. And preferences by patient was mostly influenced by risk of shortness of breath, hypotension, fatigue, impotency. And for band ligation, they were mostly worried about procedure-related bleeding. Interestingly, in all the 17 centers, none of the patients had a band ligation as a primary prophylaxis, despite that clearly the patient has had this preference. So now with the new data, right, we thought that beta blocker is good for everything and improves survival, but there are more and more data coming about. And this is a very famous study published in 2010 about patients on beta blocker with refractory ascites. It's a crossover observational study of about 151 patients. And they found out that patient with refractory ascites and non-selective beta blocker, the median survival was 5 months in this group. in patients with refractory ascites non-selective beta blocker. However, the survival patient who were not on non-selective beta blocker was about 20 months. And 1 year probability of survival was 19% versus 64%. So this is the more data coming about decompensated cirrhotic patient. And this also in this risk model, the hyponatremia and acute kidney injury was also an important factor in this setting. So now we are having this now window period theory. Like, you know, there is a group of period, there's a time that non-selective beta blocker may be useful. But as you can see that when patients become more decompensated, especially with refractory ascites and hyponatremia, the cardiac compensatory reserve is not good, and that's when we need a sympathetic nervous system to work. And that's where if you have patient on non-selective beta blocker, you can have an increased mortality. And therefore, unfortunately, most of our patients, which we see is a lot of decompensated patients, and they don't have that reserve. And if we try to use non-selective beta blocker, not only that it may not work for the vessel bleed, maybe we are harming them in the future. So when should we use pan-ligation, right? So that's what, okay, if you want to use it, beta blocker as a first line, what is the role, right? So patients who are non-compliant, 10% of the patients are non-compliant to non-selective beta blocker, and they actually stop the treatment. Patient with severe adverse side effects, they're 10 to 20% patient which you cannot actually use non-selective beta blocker, and most of the clinical trial actually exclude them. And patient with COPD, patient has lung problem, they have other baseline low blood pressure, we cannot even use non-selective beta blocker. Patient who has contraindication, non-responder to non-selective beta blocker, which is 40%, so about 70 to 80% patient we can actually use non-selective beta blocker. Decompensated cirrhosis and refractory ascites, we don't, you know, there is no number for that. And what is the patient preference and quality of life? So in summary, the band ligations compared to non-selective beta blocker decrease the risk of vessel bleed. Non-selective treatment has side effects, compliance issue, and risk of rebound portal hypertension once you stop it. It can actually impact survival in decompensated cirrhotic patient. And every patient is different and need to be individualized to make that decision. And based on this data, whether we should still believe that non-selective beta blocker is a first-line therapy. So in conclusion, band ligation is better than non-selective beta blocker for primary prophylaxis. It's fun, and you don't have to be a wizard to do it. Thank you.
I think Bilal really wants to win, so that he doesn't have to take call next year. But you know, he talks for 5 more minutes, so I'm going to give Danielle a chance to have the last word.
Well, I want to win also because I was just on call for the ASLD week. So so I think Bilal made some really excellent points. You know, I think we still have to think about, you know, who are beta blockers appropriate for. You mentioned non-compliance, and I think a non-compliant patient who's not taking medications may be non-compliant with procedures as well, especially if you're asking them to come in every 2 weeks or so for a procedure. And again, I think looking at the patients who've been included in these clinical trials, these are motivated patients who want to do what they think is really best, and that might be what's biasing some of those patient preference responses towards favoring band ligation. We still have to think about the greater population outside of the Bay Area, and I would argue in resource-poor areas, I really think that beta blockers really will come out on top in terms of cost effectiveness and availability. And I think we really still do have to think about the complication rate as well.
So let me ask you, you know, it looks like you have to really individualize the situation, right? Depending on whether you have grade 2 or grade 3, child's A or B or C. So let me ask you this question. If, say, you see gastric varices, would that make you, you know, and esophageal varices, would that make you shy away from doing prophylactic banding ligation? Either one of you?
I think I think it depends on the type of gastric varices, whether they're, I suppose they would not be isolated gastric varices if you're talking about banding esophageal varices. It would actually make me a little bit more hesitant and wondering, is that patient going to be at increased risk of enlarging of their gastric varices if I start to band their esophageal varices? So, you know, that's a patient that I might favor putting on a beta blocker rather than banding.
I agree. If there's a, gastric varices, depending on what the location is it, but now we are also seeing that we have to be, in some clinical, I think we have to see what kind of a patient, what is the risk of bleeding is, because now we are actually, if there is a patient of risk of bleeding, we're actually doing glue for the gastric varices and then eradicate the esophageal varices, but depending on what is the risk of the bleed is, whether there's a risk before, but you can start in that group with non-selective beta blocker. My concern is that how many of these patients are going to actually respond to the treatment. We talk about the cost and cost, but if someone has the mortality is still 20% at 6 weeks mark, and then all the costs will go away if, unfortunately, patient had a one bad episode and it required a long hospital stay in the ICU. So I think we have to do what we believe is the best option in which we can provide the best benefit to the patient.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Repeat the question.
Right. So the question is whether banding has any effect on the portal hypertension or whether it increased the portal gastropathy. So, banding, as you know, it's a local treatment. So it won't going to have any benefit. It won't going to increase the portal hypertension or it won't going to have any effect on portal hypertensive gastropathy. Patients who have portal hypertensive gastropathy, there's actually not a clear study that shows that, you use non-selective beta blocker with portal hypertensive gastropathy. The concept is that portal hypertensive gastropathy is related to the portal hypertension. So non-selective beta blocker should work. But already shown the data that only 30% will have a response to the pressure gradient. So whether even if you use the non-selective beta blocker, how much it will help with the portal hypertensive gastropathy or not.
So, Ajit, yes.
Yeah, so the cost-effectiveness analysis was taking into account the need for repeat endoscopy and episodes of bleeding as well.
Okay. Yes, Dr. Pauly.
I hope, that's the whole goal. We hope that we can take care of the varices before that thing happened, because most of the time we have 2 decompensated if the INR is elevated. The platelet count, everyone has their own preference. Some use 30, some use 50 as a cutoff of it, but every endoscopist has to be comfortable. I have done it 30, I have done it 50. The INR is one of those things that, there are a group of patients that, some people use it less than 1.5, some use 1.8. So there is no correct. I think it's a risk and benefit thing. And again, those group of patients which already had decompensation, the non-selective beta blocker likely gonna not work because we can't even titrate the dosages. So those group of patients, we have to be aggressive. Sometimes we admit these or, give them transfusions to get it, depending on the risk and benefit again. And that.
So there are many very smart gastroenterologists in the audience. I want to see the practice pattern. So what if I give you a scenario of a Child's A patient with platelet count of 70 who has grade 2 esophageal varices? I want to see a show of hands. How many of you would do beta blocker? How many of you would do prophylactic banding ligation? So beta blockers? Wow. Banding? It's tight. Okay. Thank you very much. All right.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.